It's a pleasure for me to introduce to you today Professor Chad Emmett. Chad is an associate professor of geography and coordinator of the International Studies Program for the Kennedy Center and is a native of Logan, Utah. He served a mission to Indonesia, then graduated from Utah State University in secondary education. He taught seminary for a year, after which he completed a master's degree here at BYU in international relations and Middle Eastern studies. After working for the National Security Agency as a linguist, he continued his education and received a PhD in geography from the University of Chicago. He taught at DePaul University and then joined our faculty here at BYU in 1992. As part of his doctoral studies, Chad spent a year in Nazareth, studying relations between Christian and Muslim Arabs. His book, resulting from that study, Beyond the Basilica, Christians and Muslims in Nazareth, has been well received by geographers and scholars of the Middle East. He continues his research interest in understanding how Israelis and Palestinians might share that land more peacefully. Chad and his wife, Marie, who is an admissions counselor here at BYU, are expecting their first child next month. Professor Emmett is an excellent representative of the BYU faculty. He is a committed and effective teacher, as well as an energetic and productive scholar. His teaching and scholarship represent a model blend of faith and intellectual achievement. We look forward to his forum today entitled Sharing Sacred Space in the Holy Land. Professor Emmett.
It's a pleasure to meet with you this morning to talk about places, peoples, and religions that I love. In 1869, as an innocent abroad, Mark Twain wrote of both shared and disputed sacred space in the Holy Land. On his visit to biblical Shechem, or present-day Nablus, he wrote, "Few tombs on earth command the veneration of so many races and men of diverse creeds as this of Joseph. Samaritan and Jew, Muslim and Christian alike, revere it and honor it with their visits." Not all holy places were as peacefully shared. During his same visit, Twain noted that in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, all sects of Christians, except Protestants, have chapels under the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and each must keep to itself and not venture upon another's ground. It has been proven conclusively that they cannot worship together around the grave of the Savior of the world in peace. In a similar reference to Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity, he observed, "The priests and the members of the Greek and Latin churches cannot come by the same corridor to kneel in their sacred birthplace of the Redeemer, but are compelled to approach and retire by different avenues, lest they quarrel and fight on this holiest ground on earth." More than a century later, some things have changed and some things have not. At the once peacefully shared tomb of Joseph, six Israeli soldiers stationed there to protect yeshiva students were killed by Palestinians as they protested the October 1996 opening of an Israeli archaeological tunnel which threatened the stability of Islam's holiest site in Jerusalem. Conversely, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, once battling Catholics, Orthodox, and Armenians, in a growing show of cooperation and neighborliness, worked together in the beautiful restoration of the dome, completed just last year. In the Church of the Nativity, there are still occasional disputes over who controls which areas. As recently as the mid-1980s, Armenian and Orthodox priests have contended over who cleans what portion of the church, for to them, cleaning connotes control. These conflicts over control of sacred space stem from the fact that three great religious traditions all view the land of Israel-Palestine as being holy. For Jews, this is the promised land, a land of patriarchs, prophets, and kings. It is also the land of temples past and future. For Christians, it is the land not only of the Old Testament prophets, but the land where Jesus walked and taught, and to where he will one day return. For Muslims, it is where prophets extending from Abraham to Jesus and on to Muhammad taught the truths of God, and where the final judgment will one day take place. As these three religions have expanded territorially and divided theologically, the Holy Land and its sacred sites have become more than just the sole claim of a single religion. The methods in which these sites have come to be shared are extremely varied. Some sites are shared peacefully, while others seem destined for continual conflict. Today I want to illustrate how these sites are shared, or in the case of a few, not shared. I will begin with those that are most peaceful and conclude with those that are most contentious. I will then look to the various models of the sacred space, of shared sacred space, to see if any of them might apply to the peaceful sharing of the entire Holy Land. The peaceful sharing of sacred space most often occurs when there is more than a single site for a sacred event. In Nazareth, there are two claimed sites for where the angel Gabriel made his annunciatory visit. In Greek Orthodox tradition, Gabriel first spoke to Mary at the village well as she refilled her pitcher. She then returned home where the angel stood before her and told her she would bear a son whom she should name Jesus. In Roman Catholic tradition, Gabriel's only visit was to Mary at her home. The Greek Orthodox are happy to commemorate the Annunciation at their Church of the Annunciation, which is centered over the well, while Catholics honor the event at the Basilica of the Annunciation, which is centered over the House of Mary. These two sites are shown in orange on the map. Nazareth is also home to two sites of Joseph's home, where Jesus would have been raised. These are shown in red on the map. The traditional site of the home of the Holy Family is the Franciscan-controlled Church of St. Joseph. However, across the street, the Sisters of Nazareth, while not wanting to contend with their Catholic brothers, still quietly claim that their excavations below their convent are indeed the childhood home of Jesus, based on compliance with the earliest known descriptions of the site. In Jerusalem, Protestants with their Golgotha and the nearby Garden Tomb have not had to compete with the claims of other Christians who revere the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as the site of the crucifixion and resurrection. In the town of Beit Zahor near Bethlehem, I was quite puzzled as a BYU Jerusalem Center student in 1982 over the numerous possibilities for the site of where the heavenly hosts visited the shepherds. There are two churches, one Greek and the other Latin Catholic, while many Mormon pilgrims prefer to congregate at their own unofficial shepherd's field. While the various Christian sects may contend over claims to authenticity, they at least are not contending over control of sacred space. They each have their own. There are plenty of fields to go around. Some sacred sites are jointly claimed and peacefully shared. Those that have known the greatest peace comprise areas large enough to accommodate dual claims. Mount Sinai is such a place. A Christian pilgrim to the mountain in 1912 wrote, "Here on the mountain, sacred to Christian and Mohammedan alike, in silent friendliness, chapel and mosque lie side by side, as if ignorant or fearful of the antagonisms of their servants in this world." The expansive summit of Mount Tabor, one of two traditional sites of the Transfiguration, is neatly divided by a rock wall. The Franciscans control the southern half and the Greek Orthodox the northern half. The much more localized sanctuary of the Ascension atop the Mount of Olives involves not only the various Christian communities, but also Muslims who have long controlled the site. A small circular dome structure houses a footprint in stone which is attributed to where Jesus stood before ascending into heaven. A mihrab, or niche, on the southern wall indicates the direction of prayer to Mecca. Surrounding the shrine is a walled circular yard with several stone altars ready for Greek Orthodox, Armenian, Copt, and Syrian services during the Feast of the Ascension. Adjacent to the shrine is an Islamic mosque. Armenians and Greek Orthodox share joint control of the tomb of the Virgin of Gethsemane. Copts and Syrians also possess rights to hold services at the Armenian altars. The Latin Catholics at one time had exclusive possession of the church, but their claim was lost in a firman or a decree from the Ottoman Sultan in 1757. The church and tomb are reached by descending a long stairway with several Orthodox altars along the way. The Armenians and the Greeks each have their own altars, while the altar at the tomb is jointly shared. The placing of lamps and candles and icons is strictly regulated. More complex is the sharing of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or Church of the Resurrection, as it is known by local Christian Arabs. The church's long history begins with Queen Helena, who identified the site as that of both Calvary and the tomb. Her son Constantine then commemorated these events by building a Byzantine basilica in 335 AD. The original basilica was set fire by Persian invaders in 614, preserved by Muslim invaders in 638, and then completely destroyed by the Muslim Fatimids in 1009. This destruction brought on the Crusades, with the present-day church being completed by the Crusaders in 1049. Throughout the centuries, different religious communities have struggled for control of the church. At one point, 10 different Christian sects shared rights in the church. However, rights often changed. In the 1400s, for example, possession of Calvary changed hands between the Armenians and Georgians five times over a period of 30 years. During the Crusade, the Latins reigned supreme, while during Ottoman times, the Greeks and Armenians, as subjects of the Sultan, gained significant rights, with the 1757 Firman granting the Greeks the majority of control in the disputed churches. Due to the contentious nature of the Holy Sepulchre, it and several other holy places, the Ottoman ruler finally decided to resolve the issue of control. Thinking it would be too problematic to try and sort out the centuries-long string of firmans with their contradictory decrees, and not wanting to offend Russia, who backed the Orthodox, and France, who backed the Catholics, the Sultan decided in 1852 to stick with current realities and establish the existing state, or status quo, as law. This meant that there would be no more changes in control of holy places, and that the current system of having to share sacred space would, in a sense, be codified. Since the issuance of the status quo, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has been shared by five religious communities in an interesting pattern of scattered sovereignty. The three main powers are the Greek Orthodox, who share the greatest portion, shown here in blue, the Armenians, shown in yellow, and the Franciscans in purple, who are the designated Catholic custos in the Holy Land. Egyptian Copts in red and Syrians in green have limited claims. Ethiopian control in orange is restricted to a monastery on the roof. Common areas shown in gray, which are shared jointly by the Greeks, Latins, and Armenians, include, among others, the entrance courtyard, the entry, the keys of which have been held by two neutral Muslim families for centuries, the edicule, which houses the tomb, and the rotunda, which rises above the edicule. In sharing these areas, each community is allowed to hang a certain number of lanterns, to post and light a certain number of candles, to sense and to worship at certain times. Any changes to those areas held in common require the consent of all parties involved. Calvary is divided into side-by-side Greek and Latin chapels. The Greek chapel is on the left. The Armenians lost their rights to Calvary in the 1400s and were compensated with control of the area opposite in what is known as the Armenian Gallery. Armenians also control the Chapel of St. Helena, which is reached by descending stairs from the Greek-controlled ambulatory. Beyond this chapel and down another flight of stairs is the Latin-controlled Chapel of the Invention of the Cross. Latins also control the chapels of Mary Magdalene and the Apparition of the Virgin. Greek control includes a central Catholicon, three chapels on the west side of the courtyard, two altars along the ambulatory, and the Chapel of Adam underneath Calvary. The Copts possess a small chapel attached to the edicule, from which pilgrims can reach in and touch the backside of the tomb. Control of the Chapel of St. Nicodemus to the west of the edicule is disputed between the Armenians and the Syrians, who are seen worshiping here. During Ottoman times, the Armenians were the official representative to the Sultan for other Eastern sects, such as the Syrians. Syrians had long used the chapel, but Armenians claimed that they did so under the good graces of the Armenians, who were willing to allow their clients to use an Armenian chapel. Also in dispute is the North Transept, or Seven Arches of the Virgin, which is claimed by both the Latins and the Greeks. The status quo did not identify rights to these areas, and so none of the claimant sects has been able to repair and furnish them. While the map of the church shows a complex mosaic of control, most visitors have no idea that the church is so divided. No borders or lines of demarcation exist. The only way to know who controls which areas is to ask a priest, notice who worships where, look at the map, or identify lamps, candles, icons, and other decorations that are specific to each community. Religious leaders and pilgrims can freely move throughout the church. On holy days, specific schedules coordinate very complex orders of procession and prayer. Tensions still persist, but relations continue to increase in amicability. Everyone knows their place and that nothing will change. This allows the religious communities to be more concerned with the daily cycles of worship than worrying about losing territory or rights. Communities still keep watch on each other to make sure that there are no violations to the status quo, but only occasionally is there cause for concern. Evidence of growing cooperation is that the Greek, Armenian, and Latin churches finally agreed to jointly restore the long-disputed rotunda. The agreement to adorn the dome with the sun motif acceptable to the various artistic traditions of the three churches was reached in 1995 with an historic signing by the Armenian and Greek patriarchs and the Latin custos of the Holy Land. Armenian Patriarch Manogian called the agreement a turning point for all Christendom. He then stated that the very fact that it was signed at all provides telling evidence of the new spirit of ecumenical rapprochement in both the Western and Eastern Christian world. The one area of the church that defies the peace of the status quo is the rooftop monastery known as Deir es-Sultan, which encircles the dome of the Chapel of St. Helena. Possession of this area has a long history of dispute between the Ethiopians and the Egyptian Copts. Like the client relationship between the Syrians and the Armenians, the Copts were originally designated by the Sultan to represent the Ethiopians, which means that Ethiopian and Coptic claims often overlap. Access to the monastery is via the Chapel of St. Michael, with its entrance from the courtyard, up some stairs into the Chapel of the Four Living Creatures, and then out into the courtyard of Deir es-Sultan. Other than a circuitous route through the markets of the Old City, access between the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Coptic Patriarchate, which lies just to the north of Deir es-Sultan. In 1838, a cholera epidemic nearly decimated the Ethiopian community of Deir es-Sultan. The Copts used the opportunity to reassert claim by petitioning a sympathetic Ibrahim Pasha during ruling from Egypt to grant them control. To solidify their claim, the Copts even resorted to burning contaminated documents which the Ethiopians used to justify their claim. The Copts, shown here, thus became the keeper of the keys to the chapels and to the monastery, while their guests, the Ethiopians, who never relinquished their claim to the lost chapels, were only allowed to live in the rooftop rooms and celebrate Easter services under a tent erected in the rooftop courtyard. This situation remained for more than a century. Then, during Easter 1970, the Ethiopians took advantage of strong ties between Israel and Ethiopia to reassert control. While the Coptic community celebrated Easter services in the main church, the Ethiopians changed the locks to the two disputed chapels. Israeli police were stationed around the monastery but did nothing to prevent the change. The Israeli courts first ruled in favor of the Copts, but then backed down and decided to take the matter under consideration, which means that the Ethiopians are still in control of the chapels. An angered Egyptian government continues to discourage its Christians from making pilgrimages to Israel until the Copts regain control of Deir es-Sultan. On Jerusalem's Mount Zion, the sharing of sacred space is complicated by the unusual fact that Muslims, Jews, and Christians all claim it as holy, particularly the structure housing David's tomb and the upper room. The upper room has traditionally been celebrated by Christians as the site of the Last Supper and the gathering at Pentecost, even though the building only dates back to the Crusader period. In 1333, the King of Naples purchased the room from the Mamluk Sultan of Egypt and then entrusted control to the Franciscans. In 1552, the Franciscans were ousted by the Muslims and the shrine was converted into the Mosque of the Prophet Dawood, based on the tradition that the lower level housed the Tomb of David. During Jordanian control of the Old City, the Tomb of David rose in prominence among Jerusalem's Jews due to the fact that Jordan denied them access to the more holy Western Wall. Since this structure was never designated a part of the status quo, Israel's Ministry of Religious Affairs has assumed the ruling role as a neutral agent. During a 1995 visit to Mount Zion, I observed Jews praying at the Tomb of David, while upstairs a group of Pentecostal pilgrims from Ohio were reveling in the spirit of the upper room, complete with its mihrab in the wall pointing the way for prayers towards Mecca. Franciscans claim control of the building, while the Israeli government oversees it, but technically the building remains a Muslim religious endowment, which is open to both Jewish and Christian visitors. Whew, complex. More problematic, even though it is claimed only by Christians, is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. Built during the Byzantine period, the structure is the oldest standing Christian church in the Holy Land. Tradition holds that it survived the Persian conquest of 614 because the invaders were impressed with the depiction of Persian magi in a mosaic on the front of the church. Long revered as the site of the birth of Jesus, the Church of the Nativity has a complex history of competition for control among the various Christian sects. One of the most noted encounters occurred in the mid-19th century when Greeks and Latins jostled for expanded control of the jointly shared but hotly contested church. During 1847, Greek monks beat Latins with staves in an attempt to drive them from holy sites in Bethlehem. Meanwhile, Latins took possession of a tapestry which they claimed marked a portion of the church that they deemed theirs. Later, a Greek bishop was wounded in a clash with members of the Latin clergy. This was followed by the mysterious disappearance of the silver star of the Nativity, which marks the site of the birth. Latins accused the Greeks of stealing the star out of fear that Latin inscriptions on the star would be used as justification by the Catholics to expand their territorial rights in the church. While what may now seem to be a rather trivial contest was at the time a very serious conflict, for it involved not only the local clergy, but also world powers with strategic interests in the region. Catholic France had long claimed the role of protectorate of the Roman Catholics in the Ottoman Empire, while its rival Orthodox Russia backed the more numerous Greek and Arab Orthodox under Ottoman control. During the Easter seasons of 1847 and 1848, France sent an armed ship to the port of Jaffa as a way of backing Latin claims to sacred sites. Meanwhile, Russian diplomats in Istanbul and emissaries in Jerusalem sought to further Orthodox claims. After several years of political maneuverings by both France and Russia, the Ottomans finally, on December 22, 1852, allowed the Latins to replace the silver star. Viewed as a setback to Greek claims in the church, Russian representatives hinted of retribution. Russian troops were mobilized in the south of Russia, and ships in the Black Sea were put on alert. Russia demanded that it be recognized as the protector of all Orthodox subjects of the Sultan, and that Latin claims in the holy places be revoked. Fearing Russian expansion into the Ottoman Empire, Britain and France began to mobilize troops and navies. Negotiations between the European powers over Ottoman-Russian relations were unfruitful, and by October 1853, war had broken out. Rivalry over holy places, and in particular the Silver Star of the Church of the Nativity, did not cause the Crimean War, but it certainly added to the already tense geopolitics of the region. While not as cataclysmic, there are still disputes over control of certain portions of the Church of the Nativity. These disputes center on cleaning and repairs, acts which serve to solidify claims. During the annual 1983 and 1984 Christmas cleanings of the church, up to 50 Armenian and Greek priests came to blows using brooms, chairs, and ladders as weapons as they fought for the right to clean a disputed 6-meter by 15-centimeter stretch of wall above the north entrance to the grotto. In an attempt to prevent a similar brawl in 1985, the two sects agreed to leave the disputed wall as an unclean sort of no man's land. The agreement worked, and it has allowed priests to annually clean the rest of the church in peace. In 1989, Latins and Armenians protested Greek attempts to repair the leaky roof of the church because it was seen as an attempt by the Greeks to assert control of the roof, something that the Latins and the Armenians considered to be jointly controlled by all three sects. Eventually, the Israeli government came in as a neutral fourth party and fixed the leaks. While not all of the above sacred sites know true peace, they at least know the absence of the intense conflicts that once plagued many of them. Minor disputes may still arise, but Ethiopia and Egypt are not about to wage war over Deir es-Sultan, and it is highly unlikely that another Crimean War would be fought over the star in the Church of the Nativity. Joint claimants of these holy sites have learned that they can coexist, however tenuous, by sharing. Unfortunately, there are other sites in the Holy Land which lack favorable formulas for the sharing of sacred space. With strong nationalist underpinnings, these sacred sites, claimed by both Muslims and Jews, have the potential of inciting future conflicts. In Hebron, Muslims and Jews both claim the tomb of the patriarch where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are buried, along with Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah. It is known as the Tomb of the Patriarchs or Cave of Machpelah by Jews and as the Mosque of Abraham by Muslim Arabs, who see it as their fourth most holy site after Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. Since Jews and Arabs claim descent from Abraham, and since both Jews and Muslims revere Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as prophets, this site has become particularly contentious. In many ways, control of the tomb has become symbolic of the attempt by Israelis to expand control into what they refer to as Judea and Samaria, and of the desire of Palestinians to establish a state of Palestine in what they refer to as the occupied West Bank. The imposing structure was built over 2,000 years ago during the Hasmonean period and is often attributed to King Herod, who used similar large stones in the construction of the temple complex in Jerusalem. During the Byzantine period, a hall for Christian prayer was located around the cenotaphs of Isaac and Rebekah, seen here, while rooms for Jewish worship were near the cenotaphs of Jacob and Leah. A pilgrim visiting the tombs in 570 noted that at the time there was sharing of this sacred place. He writes, "The Christians enter from one side and the Jews from the other, and they burn a great deal of incense and distribute gifts and candles to the students, to the attendants, and to all those praying there. They come there in multitudes from near and far. The church hall became a mosque following the Muslim conquest of 638, and then a church again during the Crusader period. With the demise of the Crusaders, the sanctuary once again became a mosque, and for over 700 years until 1976, non-Muslims were forbidden entry. Jews were only allowed to pray on the first seven steps of the southwestern stair landing. Following the Israeli conquest of the West Bank and with the approval of the military government, Jews were permitted to enter the sanctuary and then on Yom Kippur in 1968 to pray in the sanctuary. Since then, Jewish rites in the mosque have continually expanded. In 1971, an ark for Torah scrolls was placed in the Hall of Abraham, shown in the center with the darkest blue color, which then began to function as a synagogue. In 1975, the Hall of Jacob and the interior courtyard in medium blue were designated as additional areas where Jews could worship. In 1979, Jewish settlers forcibly entered the larger Hall of Isaac in the lighter blue in an attempt to further expand areas in which Jews could pray. After months of deliberations, the Israeli government authorized Jewish services in part of the hall. The ongoing Israeli encroachment within the Mosque of Abraham and within the city of Hebron has resulted in very tense relations between Jews and Arabs in the city. In 1968, a hand grenade exploded in front of the mosque among a crowd of Jewish visitors. In 1976, rare and valuable Qurans were stolen by the Jewish residents of the nearby settlement of Kiryat Arba. Angry Muslims retaliated by expelling Jewish worshippers and setting their scriptures and ceremonial objects on fire. During 1980, a yeshiva student and six settlers were murdered by Arabs, and in 1983, a Jewish settler was stabbed to death in broad daylight while walking through the Arab market. These and other incidents were always followed by reprisals by Kiryat Arba residents, including the 1983 murder of three Arab students at the Hebron Islamic College. By 1982, a sort of status quo emerged in which hours and areas of worship for Muslims and Jews were specifically defined and militarily enforced. For example, on Friday days, the entire mosque was devoted exclusively for Muslims to pray and to gather for their weekly sermon. But on Friday evenings, precisely 15 minutes before the lighting of Sabbath candles, Jews were permitted to enter, and for the rest of the Sabbath, they could pray in designated areas. At other times during the week, Jew and Muslim could be seen praying side by side in front of Father Abraham's tomb. All of this was done under the watchful eye of the Israeli military, complete with a military commander assigned to the mosque synagogue. This tenuous but workable status quo solution for sharing lasted until 1994. On an early Friday morning on February 24, 1994, Baruch Goldstein, a Jewish doctor who had emigrated from New York City to Kiryat Arba, entered the Ibrahimi Mosque and started firing his machine gun into an assembled crowd of 600 men and boys and 100 women as they knelt, heads touching the floor in prayer during the fasting month of Ramadan. Before being subdued and then beaten to death by the worshippers, Goldstein had killed 29 people, 8 boys ages 10 to 17, along with 21 men. The tomb of Goldstein in Kiryat Arba has become a place of pilgrimage for those Jews who admire his willingness to assert Jewish rights to the tomb of the patriarchs and his efforts to try and thwart the peace process and the Israeli redeployment from Hebron. Since the massacre, the tomb of the patriarchs has been rigidly divided between Jews and Muslims. Jews have turned the halls of Abraham and Jacob and the interior courtyard, seen here, into a synagogue, while Muslims use the rest of the structure as a mosque. For 10 days a year on Jewish holidays, the whole sanctuary is open for Jews to pray, and for 10 days a year, the whole area is open for Muslims to pray. Multiple security checks for all visitors now try to prevent any more violence within the shrine. The city of Hebron also requires strong security measures. In an effort to keep the peace between Abraham's descendants, the city has been divided into a Palestinian-controlled sector for the 100,000 Arabs who live in Hebron, and an Israeli-controlled sector around the Tomb of the Patriarchs and nearby enclaves where 500 Jews have settled since 1967. Muslims and Jews also compete for control of their holy shrines in Jerusalem, which include the Western Wall and towering above it, the Temple Mount as it is known to Jews, or the Haram al-Sharif or Noble Sanctuary as it is known to Muslims. The Western or Wailing Wall is part of the retaining wall built in 20 BC under the direction of King Herod to support the massive structures of the Temple Mount above. With the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, only the retaining wall remained. As the last remaining part of Judaism's most holy site, the Western Wall then became Judaism's most holy site. Muslims, however, also claim the wall as holy. It is here that the Prophet Muhammad tied up his winged steed Burak before ascending from the Haram al-Sharif on his night journey into heaven. The wall and its surrounding areas became a Muslim religious endowment or waqf, and over time Muslim migrants from Africa's Maghreb region settled in the waqf houses near the wall. Jews were allowed to come and pray at the wall, although numbers were limited due to the narrowness of the corridor in front of the wall, which measured only 4 by 28 meters, about half of the area shown in the shade. Jews were not allowed to modify or repair the wall, to bring in benches or chairs, or to blow the shofar on holidays. The Western Wall was not included in the Ottoman status quo. When nationalist-based conflicts erupted at the wall during the Mandate period, the British reaffirmed Islamic control of the area, but acknowledged the right of Jews to pray at the wall. So contentious was the issue of control at the Western Wall that riots broke out in 1929 in Jerusalem and then spread to Hebron, where 69 Jews were massacred by Arabs. Restricted Jewish rights at the wall all changed in 1967, when within days of Israel's gaining control of the Old City, the Arab Muslim residents of the Maghrebi Quarter were expelled and their houses destroyed to make way for increased access to the wall. While Muslims still claim the land as waqf, the area is now administered by the State of Israel. The large plaza in front of the wall serves as a central gathering place for both religious and nationalist functions. The adjacent Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif, with its two mosques, the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa, could have also come under Israeli control in 1967, but the government withdrew and allowed the Islamic waqf to continue to administer Islam's third most holy site. Without the temple and with no sure knowledge of where the Holy of Holies would have been located, observant Jews showed less interest in the mount than in the wall. Some Jews still insist on their right to pray on the mount, while others plan to one day build a temple there. On Easter Sunday in 1982, a follower of the extremist Koch group opened fire at the Dome of the Rock in an attempt to liberate the Temple Mount from Muslim control. Two people were killed in the shooting and at least 184 people injured when riots broke out in and around Jerusalem. Last October, the Temple Mount faithful laid a cornerstone for the third temple just outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. In 1996, an archaeological tunnel running around the western perimeter of the mount from the Western Wall to the Via Della Rosa was completed. Muslims saw this as another attempt by Israel to excavate underneath the Haram al-Sharif and its adjoining buildings in anticipation of the day when the Temple Mount would once again be under Jewish control. Protests and violence ensued, including the attack on soldiers guarding the tomb of Joseph in Nablus. Other indications of Jewish efforts to gain control of the Temple Mount and build the temple are posters of the planned new temple which are hung in Jewish establishments and are then used by Muslims in their own poster, as shown here, to warn of the need to protect the Haram al-Sharif. A model of the third temple, which is prominently displayed at a temple museum in the adjacent Jewish quarter, also illustrates Jewish designs on regaining the Temple Mount. Where exactly the future temple will be built has yet to be determined. Many believe that the temple should be built where the Dome of the Rock now stands, thus necessitating its destruction. If the Dome of the Rock were destroyed, the world's 1 billion Muslims would be enraged. From my perspective, it seems that for the sake of world peace and the preservation of things beautiful and sacred, there is plenty of vacant space on the Haram al-Sharif for the temple side by side with its mosques. While these sites are the scene of intense inter-religious conflict, they are also the site of intense intra-religious competition. The Dome of the Rock has both religious and political symbolism for Muslim Arabs in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Palestine. The Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan has long been the official caretaker. This is done with great fervor, partly as consolation for the Hashemites having lost control of Mecca and Medina to the rival Saud family in 1919. The Saudis, on the other hand, as designated protectors of the holy sites in Arabia, would also like to gain influence at another holy site. When the dome needed repairs and new gold plating, the wealthy Saudis offered to pay for its restoration. But instead, King Hussein of Jordan sold his London mansion to raise the necessary funds to ensure continued Jordanian upkeep and therefore Jordanian influence. Added to the Saudi Hashemite rift is the renascent Palestinian nation, which has co-opted the dome as a symbol of its hoped-for state. Palestinians want not only Israel to relinquish control of the Arab portions of Jerusalem, including the Haram al-Sharif, but also for Jordan, which is Israel's choice, to relinquish its caretakership of the dome. At the Western Wall, there is a growing rift between the Reform and Orthodox Jewish communities over how Jews should be able to worship at the Wall. The Orthodox call for strict segregation by gender at the Wall, while Reform Jews readily mix by gender when praying. Last year, there were several outbreaks of violence as Orthodox Jews sought to break up the mixed prayer gatherings of Reform Jews in the outlying perimeter of the Western Wall Plaza. From a distance, these squabbles and battles over sacred space can seem as childish as siblings squabbling over each of their sides of a shared bedroom, or as senseless as gangs demarcating their territory with graffiti. But for Muslims, Christians, and Jews in the Holy Land, and for their co-religionists and adherents of other religions throughout the world, sacred space is serious business. At one extreme are the thousands of Muslims and Hindus killed when a mosque in Ayodhya, India, was destroyed by Hindu nationalists in order to rebuild a long-gone temple at the site of the birth of the Hindu god Ram. A much less confrontational approach to sacred space can be found within our own religious tradition. In a study on images of the New Jerusalem among the various factions who looked to Joseph Smith as their founder, geographer Craig Campbell documents how the original temple site in Independence, Missouri, has gradually fragmented into parcels controlled by the Temple Lot Church of Christ with its chapel, the LDS Church with its visitor center, and the RLDS Church with its auditorium and temple. He concludes his study by stating, as the New Jerusalem develops, it looks increasingly and eerily like the old one. While not as contentious as their old world counterparts, the various factions with their temples, auditoriums, chapels, and visitor centers still exhibit similar interests of controlling sacred space. The desire to control sacred space extends beyond the specific sites in the Holy Land to include the entire land known today as either Israel or Palestine. Israeli Jews claim it holy, as do Muslim and Christian Arab Palestinians. To ascertain degrees of holiness is an exercise in futility. It is holy to all, and all have justified rights to the land. In a speech to BYU students in 1979, Elder Howard W. Hunter stated the following: "Both Jews and the Arabs are children of our Father. They are both children of promise, and as a church, we do not take sides. We have love and interest in each. The purpose of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to bring about love, unity, and brotherhood of the highest order. To bring about unity and brotherhood between Israelis and Palestinians, they must figure out a way in which they can share the land they love. Sharing the land of Israel-Palestine will not be easy, but perhaps there are lessons to be learned from some of the already discussed examples of sharing smaller parcels of sacred space. The first model for sharing sacred space is the Nazareth model, where competition for control of territory is ameliorated by the fact that there are two sites of the Annunciation. This ideal plan would work if history could be rewritten so that there were either multiple holy lands or that the Holy Land was holy to only one group of people. This cannot be, for the multiple claims and feelings of attachment are irreversible. A few years ago, I rode up on a ski lift with a Jewish woman from California who had spent some time in Israel. I commented that I had lived in Israel while doing research. As we talked about the conflict, she commented on how nice it would be if the Palestinians would all move to one of the 22 Arab states and let the Jews have their one state. In response to her suggestion, I told her of an Israeli, Palestinian, Arab, Greek Orthodox woman from Nazareth, seen here in purple, who, when asked if she could move to a state of Palestine if ever established in the West Bank, quickly responded, "Never." Nazareth was her home, for it is here that her family has lived for generations. She has very strong ties to that particular place, not to some distant Arab country or even a closer state of Palestine. Nazareth is the place for her, even if it means remaining as an Arab citizen of Israel. The same could be told of countless Palestinians who have similar strong attachments to place, something that can be very difficult for mobile Americans to understand. I also remember talking to an American Jewish friend in graduate school who told one day of her feelings of traveling to Israel for the first time. She talked of almost indescribable feelings of belonging and return. These intense feelings for place cannot be denied, either Arab or Jew. They are real and they are strong. There is no getting around the fact that both peoples are on the single Holy Land to stay. there will never be an alternative Holy Land. The second model is the Mount Sinai model. It calls for an equitable sharing of the land through the establishment of a secular democratic state in which Jews as well as Arabs share the same freedoms and rights. Such a plan has ancient precedents. The Lord, through his prophet Moses, admonished the Israelites, saying, "The stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." For anyone who has stood atop Mount Sinai in Egypt to watch the sunrise, they have probably done so with a host of strangers, both pilgrims and partiers from such diverse countries and religious traditions as Egyptian Muslims, Israeli Jews, Korean Presbyterians, German Lutherans, Greek Orthodox, and American Mormons. As a sacred site to all three monotheistic religious traditions and without a single religious sovereign, Mount Sinai allows all who come to revel in the grandeur and glory of the place. A new state, perhaps call it Canaan, could similarly allow for all residents in the land to participate in a true democracy. The one problem with this otherwise fair and just solution is that it would mean the demise of Israel as a Jewish state. And until Jews can feel secure and accepted wherever they may live, they will feel the need for a Jewish state as a guaranteed place of refuge. A third model is the Hebron model. It calls for a single sovereign state, either Jewish or Arab, to be established throughout the entire land. This plan is what the minority Israeli and Palestinian extremists want. They want it all. In many ways, they are like wicked King Ahab of old, who killed in order to gain possession of Naboth's vineyard. Terrorism in the form of Palestinian hijackers and suicide bombers, an ethnic cleansing in the form of forced expulsion of the Arabs in 1948, and the continued demolition of Palestinian homes by the Israeli government are methods used to maintain or create such exclusionist states. Such exclusion will not last when there are such strong ties to the land. Hebron's Tomb of the Patriarchs, Mosque of Abraham, was first Christian, then Muslim, then Christian, then exclusively Muslim for 700 years, and yet beginning in 1967, Jews have gradually moved in and now control a significant portion of the structure. No single religion has been able to maintain control of the Tomb of Abraham, and no single state has been able to maintain control of what was anciently known as the Land of Canaan. Roots run deep and memories endure. Jews dreamed for nearly 2,000 years before finally being able to return to their ancestral land. Palestinians talk of steadfastly enduring on the land under Israeli rule, knowing that in this shatterbelt region of the world, things will change. The Hebron model is not a solution. It is a prescription for endless conflict. The final and most feasible solution from my perspective is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre model, for it is here that after centuries of feuding and fighting, multiple claimants to a very holy place have learned to share. That sharing is in the form of scattered sovereignty in which each group has control over its designated places. The idea of partitioning place is not new to the Middle East. When there was strife between the herdmen of Abraham and his nephew Lot, Abraham said to Lot, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left, then I will take the right, and if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left." For centuries under the reign of Islam, minorities coexisted in cities through the establishment of religious, ethnic, and family quarters. Muslims, Jews, Christians, and Armenians lived together peacefully in their separate four quarters of Jerusalem. Likewise, Orthodox, Latin, and Muslim quarters in Nazareth, Armenian quarters in Beirut and Aleppo, Coptic quarters in Cairo, and Jewish quarters from Morocco to Yemen all helped to protect and preserve religious minorities living in the House of Islam. The status quo division of the territory in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and other sacred sites, as well as the establishment of quarters in the cities of the Middle East, are not an immediate or lasting guarantee of peaceful coexistence, but separation sometimes seems to be the only solution. Such must be the case for Israelis and Palestinians. Both need a state. In 1947, the United Nations voted to partition the land. Jews, who made up only one-third of the population, welcomed the plan and were happy to settle for even a small, fragmented state. Arabs, on the other hand, who were the majority of the population and controlled the vast majority of the land, rejected partition, for it only gave them 43% of the land of Palestine. 50 years later, things have reversed. Israel now rejects the idea of partition, While most Arabs would be happy to settle for a small fragmented state comprised of just the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, a fraction of what they consider to be Palestine. How to create and maintain those states is not an easy task, for the two peoples are very intertwined in terms of history and settlement patterns. It will require compromise and forgetting on both sides. It, however, can and should be done. Through the establishment of two states, Israel and Palestine, with Jerusalem as a shared capital, the sacred space of the Holy Land might finally be shared in peace. Thank you very much. While the map of the church shows a complex mosaic of control, most visitors have no idea that the church is so divided. No borders or lines of demarcation exist. The only way to know who controls which areas is to ask a priest, notice who worships where, look at the map, or identify lamps, candles, icons, and other decorations that are specific to each community. Religious leaders and pilgrims can freely move throughout the church. On holy days, specific schedules coordinate very complex orders of procession and prayer. Tensions still persist, but relations continue to increase in amicability. Everyone knows their place and that nothing will change. This allows the religious communities to be more concerned with the daily cycles of worship than worrying about losing territory or rights. Communities still keep watch on each other to make sure that there are no violations to the status quo, but only occasionally is there cause for concern. Evidence of growing cooperation is that the Greek, Armenian, and Latin churches finally agreed to jointly restore the long-disputed rotunda. The agreement to adorn the dome with the sun motif acceptable to the various artistic traditions of the three churches was reached in 1995 with an historic signing by the Armenian and Greek patriarchs and the Latin Custos of the Holy Land. Armenian Patriarch Manoogian called the agreement a turning point for all Christendom. He then stated that the very fact that it was signed at all provides telling evidence of the new spirit of ecumenical rapprochement in both the Western and Eastern Christian world. The one area of the church that defies the peace of the status quo is the rooftop monastery known as Deir es-Sultan, which encircles the dome of the Chapel of St. Helena. Possession of this area has a long history of dispute between the Ethiopians and the Egyptian Copts. Like the client relationship between the Syrians and the Armenians, the Copts were originally designated by the Sultan to represent the Ethiopians, which means that Ethiopian and Coptic claims often overlap. Access to the monastery is via the Chapel of St. Michael, with its entrance from the courtyard, up some stairs into the Chapel of the Four Living Creatures, and then out into the courtyard of Deir es-Sultan. Other than a circuitous route through the markets of the Old City, access between the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Coptic Patriarchate, which lies just to the north of Deir es-Sultan. In 1838, a cholera epidemic nearly decimated the Ethiopian community of Deir es-Sultan. The Copts used the opportunity to reassert claim by petitioning a sympathetic Ibrahim Pasha during ruling from Egypt to grant them control. To solidify their claim, the Copts even resorted to burning contaminated documents with the Ethiopians used to justify their claim. The Copts, shown here, thus became the keeper of the keys to the chapels and to the monastery, while their guests, the Ethiopians, who never relinquished their claim to the lost chapels, were only allowed to live in the rooftop rooms and celebrate Easter services under a tent erected in the rooftop courtyard. This situation remained for more than a century. Then, during Easter 1970, the Ethiopians took advantage of strong ties between Israel and Ethiopia to reassert control. While the Coptic community celebrated Easter services in the main church, the Ethiopians changed the locks to the two disputed chapels. Israeli police were stationed around the monastery but did nothing to prevent the change. The Israeli courts first ruled in favor of the Copts, but then backed down and decided to take the matter under consideration, which means that the Ethiopians are still in control of the chapels. An angered Egyptian government continues to discourage its Christians from making pilgrimages to Israel until the Copts regain control of Deir es-Sultan. On Jerusalem's Mount Zion, the sharing of sacred space is complicated by the unusual fact that Muslims, Jews, and Christians all claim it as holy, particularly the structure housing David's tomb and the upper room. The upper room has traditionally been celebrated by Christians as the site of the Last Supper and the gathering at Pentecost, even though the building only dates back to the Crusader period. In 1333, the King of Naples purchased the room from the Mamluk Sultan of Egypt and then entrusted control to the Franciscans. In 1552, the Franciscans were ousted by the Muslims, and the shrine was converted into the Mosque of the Prophet Dawood, based on the tradition that the lower level housed the Tomb of David. During Jordanian control of the Old City, the Tomb of David rose in prominence among Jerusalem's Jews due to the fact that Jordan denied them access to the more holy Western Wall. Since this structure was never designated a part of the status quo, Israel's Ministry of Religious Affairs has assumed the ruling role as a neutral agent. During a 1995 visit to Mount Zion, I observed Jews praying at the Tomb of David, while upstairs a group of Pentecostal pilgrims from Ohio were reveling in the spirit of the upper room, complete with its mihrab in the wall pointing the way for prayers towards Mecca. Franciscans claim control of the building while the Israeli government oversees it, but technically the building remains a Muslim religious endowment which is open to both Jewish and Christian visitors. Whew, complex. More problematic, even though it is claimed only by Christians, is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. Built during the Byzantine period, the structure is the oldest standing Christian church in the Holy Land. Tradition holds that it survived the Persian conquest of 614 because the invaders were impressed with the depiction of Persian magi in a mosaic on the front of the church. Long revered as the site of the birth of Jesus, the Church of the Nativity has a complex history of competition for control among the various Christian sects. One of the most noted encounters occurred in the mid-19th century when Greeks and Latins jostled for expanded control of the jointly shared but hotly contested church. During 1847, Greek monks beat Latins with staves in an attempt to drive them from holy sites in Bethlehem. Meanwhile, Latins took possession of a tapestry which they claimed marked a portion of the church that they deemed theirs. Later, a Greek bishop was wounded in a clash with members of the Latin clergy. This was followed by the mysterious disappearance of the silver star of the Nativity, which marks the site of the birth. Latins accused the Greeks of stealing the star out of fear that Latin inscriptions on the star would be used as justification by the Catholics to expand their territorial rights in the church. While what may now seem to be a rather trivial contest was at the time a very serious conflict, for it involved not only the local clergy, but also world powers with strategic interests in the region. Catholic France had long claimed the role of protectorate of the Roman Catholics in the Ottoman Empire, while its rival Orthodox Russia backed the more numerous Greek and Arab Orthodox under Ottoman control. During the Easter seasons of 1847 and 1848, France sent an armed ship to the port of Jaffa as a way of backing Latin claims to sacred sites. Meanwhile, Russian diplomats in Istanbul and emissaries in Jerusalem sought to further Orthodox claims. After several years of political maneuverings by both France and Russia, the Ottomans finally, on December 22, 1852, allowed the Latins to replace the silver star, viewed as a setback to Greek claims in the church. Russian representatives hinted of retribution. Russian troops were mobilized in the south of Russia, and ships in the Black Sea were put on alert. Russia demanded that it be recognized as the protector of all Orthodox subjects of the Sultan, and that Latin claims in the holy places be revoked. Fearing Russian expansion into the Ottoman Empire, Britain and France began to mobilize troops and navies. Negotiations between the European powers over Ottoman-Russian relations were unfruitful, and by October 1853, war had broken out. Rivalry over holy places, and in particular the silver star of the Church of the Nativity, did not cause the Crimean War, but it certainly added to the already tense geopolitics of the region. While not as cataclysmic, there are still disputes over control of certain portions of the Church of the Nativity. These disputes center on cleaning and repairs, acts which serve to solidify claims. During the annual 1983 and 1984 Christmas cleanings of the church, up to 50 Armenian and Greek priests came to blows using brooms, chairs, and ladders as weapons as they fought for the right to clean a disputed 6-meter by 15-centimeter stretch of wall above the north entrance to the grotto. In an attempt to prevent a similar brawl in 1985, the two sects agreed to leave the disputed wall as an unclean sort of no man's land. The agreement worked, and it has allowed priests to annually clean the rest of the church in peace. In 1989, Latins and Armenians protested Greek attempts to repair the leaky roof of the church because it was seen as an attempt by the Greeks to assert control of the roof, something that the Latins and the Armenians considered to be jointly controlled by all three sects. Eventually, the Israeli government came in as a neutral fourth party and fixed the leaks. While not all of the above sacred sites know true peace, they at least know the absence of the intense conflicts that once plagued many of them. Minor disputes may still arise, but Ethiopia and Egypt are not about to wage war over Deir es-Sultan, and it is highly unlikely that another Crimean war would be fought over the star in the Church of the Nativity. Joint claimants of these holy sites have learned that they can coexist, however tenuous, by sharing. Unfortunately, there are other sites in the Holy Land which lack favorable formulas for the sharing of sacred space. With strong nationalist underpinnings, these sacred sites, claimed by both Muslims and Jews, have the potential of inciting future conflicts. In Hebron, Muslims and Jews both claim the tomb of the patriarch where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are buried, along with Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah. It is known as the Tomb of the Patriarchs, or Cave of Machpelah, by Jews, and as the Mosque of Abraham by Muslim Arabs, who see it as their fourth most holy site after Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. Since Jews and Arabs claim descent from Abraham, and since both Jews and Muslims revere Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as prophets, this site has become particularly contentious. In many ways, control of the tomb has become symbolic of the attempt by Israelis to expand control into what they refer to as Judea and Samaria, and of the desire of Palestinians to establish a state of Palestine in what they refer to as the occupied West Bank. The imposing structure was built over 2,000 years ago during the Hasmonean period and is often attributed to King Herod, who used similar large stones in the construction of the temple complex in Jerusalem. During the Byzantine period, a hall for Christian prayer was located around the cenotaphs of Isaac and Rebekah, seen here, while rooms for Jewish worship were near the cenotaphs of Jacob and Leah. A pilgrim visiting the tombs in 570 noted that at the time there was sharing of this sacred place. He writes, "The Christians enter from one side and the Jews from the other, and they burn a great deal of incense and distribute gifts and candles to the students, to the attendants, and to all those praying there. They come there in multitudes from near and far. The church hall became a mosque following the Muslim conquest of 638 and then a church again during the Crusader period. With the demise of the Crusaders, the sanctuary once again became a mosque, and for over 700 years until 1976, non-Muslims were forbidden entry. Jews were only allowed to pray on the first seven steps of the southwestern stair landing. Following the Israeli conquest of the West Bank and with the approval of the military government, Jews were permitted to enter the sanctuary and then on Yom Kippur in 1968 to pray in the sanctuary. Since then, Jewish rites in the mosque have continually expanded. In 1971, an ark for Torah scrolls was placed in the Hall of Abraham, shown in the center with the darkest blue color, which then began to function as a synagogue. In 1975, the Hall of Jacob and the interior courtyard in medium blue were designated as additional areas where Jews could worship. In 1979, Jewish settlers forcibly entered the larger Hall of Isaac in the lighter blue in an attempt to further expand areas in which Jews could pray. After months of deliberations, the Israeli government authorized Jewish services in part of the hall. The ongoing Israeli encroachment within the Mosque of Abraham and within the city of Hebron has resulted in very tense relations between Jews and Arabs in the city. In 1968, a hand grenade exploded in front of the mosque among a crowd of Jewish visitors. In 1976, rare and valuable Qurans were stolen by the Jewish residents of the nearby settlement of Kiryat Arba. Angry Muslims retaliated by expelling Jewish worshippers and setting their scriptures and ceremonial objects on fire. During 1980, a yeshiva student and six settlers were murdered by Arabs, and in 1983, a Jewish settler was stabbed to death in broad daylight while walking through the Arab market. These and other incidents were always followed by reprisals by Kiryat Arba residents, including the 1983 murder of three Arab students at the Hebron Islamic College. By 1982, a sort of status quo emerged in which hours and areas of worship for Muslims and Jews were specifically defined and militarily enforced. For example, on Friday days, the entire mosque was devoted exclusively for Muslims to pray and to gather for their weekly sermon. But on Friday evenings, precisely 15 minutes before the lighting of Sabbath candles, Jews were permitted to enter, and for the rest of the Sabbath, they could pray in designated areas. At other times during the week, Jew and Muslim could be seen praying side by side in front of Father Abraham's tomb. All of this was done under the watchful eye of the Israeli military, complete with a military commander assigned to the mosque synagogue. This tenuous but workable status quo solution for sharing lasted until 1994. On an early Friday morning on February 24, 1994, Baruch Goldstein, a Jewish doctor who had emigrated from New York City to Kiryat Arba, entered the Ibrahimi Mosque and started firing his machine gun into an assembled crowd of 600 men and boys and 100 women as they knelt, heads touching the floor in prayer during the fasting month of Ramadan. Before being subdued and then beaten to death by the worshippers, Goldstein had killed 29 people, 8 boys ages 10 to 17, along with 21 men. The tomb of Goldstein in Kiryat Arba has become a place of pilgrimage for those Jews who admire his willingness to assert Jewish rights to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and his efforts to try and thwart the peace process and the Israeli redeployment from Hebron. Since the massacre, the Tomb of the Patriarchs has been rigidly divided between Jews and Muslims. Jews have turned the halls of Abraham and Jacob and the interior courtyard seen here into a synagogue, while Muslims use the rest of the structure as a mosque. For 10 days a year on Jewish holidays, the whole sanctuary is open for Jews to pray, and for 10 days a year, the whole area is open for Muslims to pray. Multiple security checks for all visitors now try to prevent any more violence within the shrine. The city of Hebron also requires strong security measures. In an effort to keep the peace between Abraham's descendants, the city has been divided into a Palestinian-controlled sector for the 100,000 Arabs who live in Hebron, and an Israeli-controlled sector around the Tomb of the Patriarchs and nearby enclaves where 500 Jews have settled since 1967. Muslims and Jews also compete for control of their holy shrines in Jerusalem, which include the Western Wall and towering above it, the Temple Mount as it is known to Jews, or the Haram al-Sharif or Noble Sanctuary as it is known to Muslims. The Western or Wailing Wall is part of the retaining wall built in 20 BC under the direction of King Herod to support the massive structures of the Temple Mount above. With the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, only the retaining wall remained. As the last remaining part of Judaism's most holy site, the Western Wall then became Judaism's most holy site. Muslims, however, also claim the wall as holy. It is here that the Prophet Muhammad tied up his winged steed Burak before ascending from the Haram al-Sharif on his night journey into heaven. The wall and its surrounding areas became a Muslim religious endowment or waqf, and over time Muslim migrants from Africa's Maghreb region settled in the waqf houses near the wall. Jews were allowed to come and pray at the wall, although numbers were limited due to the narrowness of the corridor in front of the wall, which measured only 4 by 28 meters, about half of the area shown in the shade. Jews were not allowed to modify or repair the wall, to bring in benches or chairs, or to blow the shofar on holidays. The Western Wall was not included in the Ottoman status quo. When nationalist-based conflicts erupted at the wall during the Mandate period, the British reaffirmed Islamic control of the area, but acknowledged the right of Jews to pray at the wall. So contentious was the issue of control at the Western Wall that riots broke out in 1929 in Jerusalem and then spread to Hebron, where 69 Jews were massacred by Arabs. Restricted Jewish rights at the wall all changed in 1967, when within days of Israel's gaining control of the Old City, the Arab-Muslim residents of the Maghrebi Quarter were expelled and their houses destroyed to make way for increased access to the wall. While Muslims still claim the land as waqf, the area is now administered by the State of Israel. The large plaza in front of the wall serves as a central gathering place for both religious and nationalist functions. The adjacent Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif, with its two mosques, the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa, could have also come under Israeli control in 1967, but the government withdrew and allowed the Islamic waqf to continue to administer Islam's third most holy site. Without the temple and with no sure knowledge of where the Holy of Holies would have been located, observant Jews showed less interest in the mount than in the wall. Some Jews still insist on their right to pray on the mount, while others plan to one day build a temple there. On Easter Sunday in 1982, a follower of the extremist Koch group opened fire at the Dome of the Rock in an attempt to liberate the Temple Mount from Muslim control. 2 people were killed in the shooting and at least 184 people injured when riots broke out in and around Jerusalem. Last October, the Temple Mount faithful laid a cornerstone for the third temple just outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. In 1996, an archaeological tunnel running around the western perimeter of the mount from the Western Wall to the Via Dolorosa was completed. Muslims saw this as another attempt by the Israel to excavate underneath the Haram al-Sharif and its adjoining buildings in anticipation of the day when the Temple Mount would once again be under Jewish control. Protests and violence ensued, including the attack on soldiers guarding the tomb of Joseph in Nablus. Other indications of Jewish efforts to gain control of the Temple Mount and build the temple are posters of the planned new temple which are hung in Jewish establishments and are then used by Muslims in their own poster, as shown here, to warn of the need to protect the Haram al-Sharif. A model of the Third Temple, which is prominently displayed at a temple museum in the adjacent Jewish quarter, also illustrates Jewish designs on regaining the Temple Mount. Where exactly the future temple will be built has yet to be determined. Many believe that the temple should be built where the Dome of the Rock now stands, thus necessitating its destruction. If the Dome of the Rock were destroyed, the world's 1 billion Muslims would be enraged. From my perspective, it seems that for the sake of world peace and the preservation of things beautiful and sacred, there is plenty of vacant space on the Haram al-Sharif for the temple side by side with its mosques. While these sites are the scene of intense inter-religious conflict, they are also the site of intense intra-religious competition. The Dome of the Rock has both religious and political symbolism for Muslim Arabs in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Palestine. The Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan has long been the official caretaker. This is done with great fervor, partly as consolation for the Hashemites having lost control of Mecca and Medina to the rival Saud family in 1919. The Saudis, on the other hand, as designated protectors of the holy sites in Arabia, would also like to gain influence at another holy site. When the dome needed repairs and new gold plating, the wealthy Saudis offered to pay for its restoration. But instead, King Hussein of Jordan sold his London mansion to raise the necessary funds to ensure continued Jordanian upkeep and therefore Jordanian influence. Added to the Saudi Hashemite rift is the renascent Palestinian nation, which has co-opted the dome as a symbol of its hoped-for state. Palestinians want not only Israel to relinquish control of the Arab portions of Jerusalem, including the Haram al-Sharif, but also for Jordan, which is Israel's choice, to relinquish its caretakership of the dome. At the Western Wall, there is a growing rift between the Reform and Orthodox Jewish communities over how Jews should be able to worship at the Wall. The Orthodox call for strict segregation by gender at the Wall, while Reformed Jews readily mix by gender when praying. Last year, there were several outbreaks of violence as Orthodox Jews sought to break up the mixed prayer gatherings of Reformed Jews in the outlying perimeter of the Western Wall Plaza. From a distance, these squabbles and battles over sacred space can seem as childish as siblings squabbling over each of their sides of a shared bedroom, or as senseless as gangs demarcating their territory with graffiti. But for Muslims, Christians, and Jews in the Holy Land, and for their co-religionists and adherents of other religions throughout the world, sacred space is serious business. At one extreme are the thousands of Muslims and Hindus killed when a mosque in Ayodhya, India, was destroyed by Hindu nationalists in order to rebuild a long-gone temple at the site of the birth of the Hindu god Ram. A much less confrontational approach to sacred space can be found within our own religious tradition. In a study on images of the New Jerusalem among the various factions who look to Joseph Smith as their founder, geographer Craig Campbell documents how the original temple site in Independence, Missouri, has gradually fragmented into parcels controlled by the Temple Lot Church of Christ with its chapel, the LDS Church with its visitor center, and the RLDS Church with its auditorium and temple. He concludes his study by stating, as the New Jerusalem develops, it looks increasingly and eerily like the old one. While not as contentious as their old world counterparts, the various factions with their temples, auditoriums, chapels, and visitor centers still exhibit similar interests of controlling sacred space. The desire to control sacred space extends beyond the specific sites in the Holy Land to include the entire land known today as either Israel or Palestine. Israeli Jews claim it holy, as do Muslim and Christian Arab Palestinians. To ascertain degrees of holiness is an exercise in futility. It is holy to all, and all have justified rights to the land. In a speech to BYU students in 1979, Elder Howard W. Hunter stated the following: "Both Jews and the Arabs are children of our Father. They are both children of promise, and as a church, we do not take sides. We have love and interest in each. The purpose of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to bring about love, unity, and brotherhood of the highest order. To bring about unity and brotherhood between Israelis and Palestinians, they must figure out a way in which they can share the land they love. Sharing the land of Israel-Palestine will not be easy, but perhaps there are lessons to be learned from some of the already discussed examples of sharing smaller parcels of sacred space. The first model for sharing sacred space is the Nazareth model, where competition for control of territory is ameliorated by the fact that there are two sites of the Annunciation. This ideal plan would work if history could be rewritten so that there were either multiple holy lands or that the holy land was holy to only one group of people. This cannot be, for the multiple claims and feelings of attachment are irreversible. A few years ago, I rode up on a ski lift with a Jewish woman from California who had spent some time in Israel. I commented that I had lived in Israel while doing research. As we talked about the conflict, she commented on how nice it would be if the Palestinians would all move to one of the 22 Arab states and let the Jews have their one state. In response to her suggestion, I told her of an Israeli, Palestinian, Arab, Greek Orthodox woman from Nazareth, seen here in purple, who, when asked if she could move to a state of Palestine if ever established in the West Bank, quickly responded, "Never." Nazareth was her home, for it is here that her family has lived for generations. She has very strong ties to that particular place, not to some distant Arab country or even a closer state of Palestine. Nazareth is the place for her, even if it means remaining as an Arab citizen of Israel. The same could be told of countless Palestinians who have similar strong attachments to place, something that can be very difficult for mobile Americans to understand. I also remember talking to an American Jewish friend in graduate school who told one day of her feelings of traveling to Israel for the first time. She talked of almost indescribable feelings of belonging and return. These intense feelings for place cannot be denied, either Arab or Jew. They are real and they are strong. There is no getting around the fact that both peoples are on the single Holy Land to stay. There will never be an alternative Holy Land. The second model is the Mount Sinai model. It calls for an equitable sharing of the land through the establishment of a secular democratic state in which Jews as well as Arabs share the same freedoms and rights. Such a plan has ancient precedents. The Lord, through his prophet Moses, admonished the Israelites, saying, "The stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." For anyone who has stood atop Mount Sinai in Egypt to watch the sunrise, they have probably done so with a host of strangers, both pilgrims and partiers from such diverse countries and religious traditions as Egyptian Muslims, Israeli Jews, Korean Presbyterians, German Lutherans, Greek Orthodox, and American Mormons. As a sacred site to all three monotheistic religious traditions, and without a single religious sovereign, Mount Sinai allows all who come to revel in the grandeur and glory of the place. A new state, perhaps call it Canaan, could similarly allow for all residents in the land to participate in a true democracy. The one problem with this otherwise fair and just solution is that it would mean the demise of Israel as a Jewish state. And until Jews can feel secure and accepted wherever they may live, they will feel the need for a Jewish state as a guaranteed place of refuge. A third model is the Hebron model. It calls for a single sovereign state, either Jewish or Arab, to be established throughout the entire land. This plan is what the minority Israeli and Palestinian extremists want. They want it all. In many ways, they are like wicked King Ahab of old, who killed in order to gain possession of Naboth's vineyard. Terrorism in the form of Palestinian hijackers and suicide bombers, an ethnic cleansing in the form of forced expulsion of the Arabs in 1948, and the continued demolition of Palestinian homes by the Israeli government are methods used to maintain or create such exclusionist states. Such exclusion will not last when there are such strong ties to the land. Hebron's Tomb of the Patriarchs, Mosque of Abraham, was first Christian, then Muslim, then Christian, then exclusively Muslim for 700 years, and yet beginning in 1967, Jews have gradually moved in and now control a significant portion of the structure. No single religion has been able to maintain control of the Tomb of Abraham, and no single state has been able to maintain control of what was anciently known as the Land of Canaan. Roots run deep and memories endure. Jews dreamed for nearly 2,000 years before finally being able to return to their ancestral land. Palestinians talk of steadfastly enduring on the land under Israeli rule. knowing that in this shatterbelt region of the world, things will change. The Hebron model is not a solution. It is a prescription for endless conflict. The final and most feasible solution from my perspective is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre model, for it is here that after centuries of feuding and fighting, multiple claimants to a very holy place have learned to share. That sharing is in the form of scattered sovereignty in which each group has control over its designated places. The idea of partitioning place is not new to the Middle East. When there was strife between the herdmen of Abraham and his nephew Lot, Abraham said to Lot, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left, then I will take the right, and if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left." For centuries under the reign of Islam, minorities coexisted in cities through the establishment of religious, ethnic, and family quarters. Muslims, Jews, Christians, and Armenians lived together peacefully in their separate four quarters of Jerusalem. Likewise, Orthodox, Latin, and Muslim quarters in Nazareth, Armenian quarters in Beirut and Aleppo, Coptic quarters in Cairo, and Jewish quarters from Morocco to Yemen all helped to protect and preserve religious minorities living in the House of Islam. The status quo division of the territory and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and other sacred sites, as well as the establishment of quarters in the cities of the Middle East, are not an immediate or lasting guarantee of peaceful coexistence, but separation sometimes seems to be the only solution. Such must be the case for Israelis and Palestinians. Both need a state. In 1947, the United Nations voted to partition the land. Jews, who made up only one-third of the population, welcomed the plan and were happy to settle for even a small, fragmented state. Arabs, on the other hand, who were the majority of the population and controlled the vast majority of the land, rejected partition, for it only gave them 43% of the land of Palestine. 50 years later, things have reversed. Israel now rejects the idea of partition, while most Arabs would be happy to settle for a small, fragmented state comprised of just the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, a fraction of what they consider to be Palestine. How to create and maintain those states is not an easy task, for the two peoples are very intertwined in terms of history and settlement patterns. It will require compromise and forgetting on both sides. It, however, can and should be done. Through the establishment of two states, Israel and Palestine, with Jerusalem as a shared capital, the sacred space of the Holy Land might finally be shared in peace. Thank you very much.